Hello, everyone. This is Stephen Strang, and welcome to this edition of In Depth with Stephen Strang. I try to probe and get to the bottom of the story, to pull out answers that will give my readers and my listeners insight into people who are significant. I ask them about how they got saved, how they received the baptism of the Holy Spirit, how they met their spouses. I try to dig down and get them to talk about things that are important, their successes, their failures, because even though these people are well known, even though they have their own media platforms, they don't often have an opportunity to talk about this side of their life. So I'm inviting you to tune in, to download, to listen, and to share In Depth with Stephen Strang. Hello, everyone. I'm Stephen Strang, and welcome to In Depth with Stephen Strang. And I am going in depth today with Jim Baker. In fact, this is part two. He is such an amazing man with such an amazing history. We couldn't cover all of it in 30 minutes. And of course, we're sharing this with the viewers of the Jim Baker Show as kind of a premium gift, but it gives me an opportunity to have a real celebrity. And I'll say this before I get you started, that in my opinion, you know, in our earlier podcast, we're talking about Oral Roberts, and of course, Billy Graham recently went to heaven. There are a lot of great men of God that have gone on before, but in my opinion, Jim, you are in that same league. You are historic. And so we've talked on our previous podcast about how you started in Michigan, went to Bible school, felt the call of God, got involved with Pat Robertson. And it's just amazing. You helped the 700 Club get started. You helped TBN get started. And then you built this huge ministry in Charlotte, which was not only probably the largest parachurch ministry at the time in the nation of any kind, whether it was Campus Crusade or 700 Club or even the Billy Graham Association, but it was the number one tourist attraction in the state of North Carolina. And even my wife and my son, who was young at the time, we went there on vacation. And it was so nice because I could just let my son run around Heritage USA. It was, to me, it was like heaven on earth. And it was just so tragic to watch what happened. So let's go in depth a little bit.
I've never dealt with that, by the way.
Dealt with what?
The pain of losing that and what happened to me and what happened to it.
Why do you think it happened?
Oh, that's another joke. You mentioned Billy Graham and Oral Roberts, and they are two of my mentors. They showed me love of God. Billy Graham came to prison to see me. And that's jumping ahead of our story, I guess. But Billy Graham has been amazing to me. And Oral Roberts, honestly, I could do a whole show with you just on Oral Roberts and the stuff he taught me. You know, like the reason, like he told me one thing that I'll never forget. Every preacher, he said, "Jim, I've never had any money when I start building a building. Never." So you can see I have projects around here. And there's holes in the ground. I have an amphitheater that the base of it's all done. It's just sitting here. I have to raise the money for it sometime. But God spoke to me the vision. So, but Oral Roberts says, when God speaks you to build something, dig a hole. This is what he told me.
As an act of faith.
As an act of faith. Build the foundation, but get started. And I'm telling you, this place here, and, you know, we've had help doing some of these things. But it's all a miracle. But it's the Oral Roberts foundation of what he said and that taught me. But people always say, "Oh, I don't know if there's any real Christians." I'll tell you what, there's a lot of real Christians. And I've seen them. And the Graham family, when I stepped out of prison and no place to go, I didn't have a house, I didn't have a car, I didn't have anything. And Ruth Graham invited me this first Sunday I was out of to go to church with her and then to come to their house and have dinner with them. I mean, they're their most real Christians, and they're real people. They're real Christians. And I'm so tired of people saying, "Oh, they're all phonies out there." They're not.
Well, I had the privilege of knowing Oral Roberts too, and I would
Did you ever hear him talk about anything but God and Jesus
never.
In the Bible?
He was a great man.
But, he never talked about anything, whether I was in an airplane with him or walking somewhere. It was always God, God, God. Well, I'll tell you what, if he's a phony, he's a crazy phony, because he can't be. He loved God so much, it just came out all the time, just talking about it.
Well, I'll tell you something that I don't think I've ever told this publicly, but he had a controversy, I'll call it, of where he said that God was going to take him home if he didn't raise a certain amount of money.
That's right.
Which I believe led to your problems, and I'll explain why. He wanted to build, he had built this great building, and he was building a medical school, and he was having trouble bringing in all the money because that's very, very expensive. And he was trying to appeal to his partners to help him. And he said something that I'm probably not saying it quite right, because I think the press actually influenced all of us in how we saw it. Yeah. But he said that if he didn't raise the money, he felt that the Lord was going to take him home.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I heard him say that at Charismatic Bible Ministries in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Hayford, all these people were there. They heard the same thing. It was no big deal. Then he said it on his TV show, and the secular people said that God was going to kill him. He didn't say that at all. What he was saying is, a lot of us believe as Christians, you know, if there's a funeral and maybe somebody dies at 55 or 60 or a younger age, and we say, he must have finished the work that God had for him. And the Lord took him. It was sort of like that. But the media had a feeding frenzy.
Right.
That happened in January. March and April, your story popped up. So the media, the national media, had been covering that. So when your story came up, which would have just been probably in the Charlotte area, there was like a feeding frenzy. They just went crazy, and then one thing happened, and then they get all these stories, and it just spun out of control. And then you turned the whole thing over to another ministry. And why do you think all that happened?
I still don't know why. I know that it all worked together for good, because I studied in the prison, and I studied the revelation like one word at a time. And it's changed my life, changed my theology a lot. And all things work together for good.
The Bible says that.
And I'm telling you, I believe it. I have to.
You lost everything. You know, I've built a much smaller organization than you. I can't imagine what it would feel like to lose it all. You lost it all. You lost your personal wealth. You lost your family. You lost your home. You lost your first wife and went to prison. I can't imagine. How did it feel?
It's so deep that I'm not sure I've even dealt with it. When I was in the prison the first years, and the thing when you're talking about Oral Roberts and the press and all, what people got to understand, when God's called you to do something, and you have to understand, Oral Roberts is a man of God. And he was going to finish what God called him to do.
And the money finally did come in.
Or die.
Yeah.
He really felt that. But they make fun of it. That's why I don't do interviews anymore. They just make fun of what is holy and special. And God is an amazing God. And I don't want to phony it up. And when I went to prison, and boy, this is such a big story. The book was actually 700 pages long.
700, wow. And I read every page of it.
And it was originally 1,400 pages long, and then had it edited it down to 700 pages. Wherever the original is. I literally wrote the book with my co-writer to help me. And we wrote that whole book. And I told him, I said, I am going to tell you everything. I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm going to tell you everything just as it was. I'm going to name names. I'm going to say everything I have. And I said, then we'll edit it. And that's what we did. And somewhere, I shouldn't say this because someone's going to go try to get that book, because the pure message is in that book that I wrote beginning. And by the time we edited out, I don't want to hurt anybody, so I had to edit things that would hurt people. And so I edited a lot out. In fact, the original book, though, did not have the downfall, the affair that I had for 10 minutes. I didn't write that in the original book. And the publishers forced me big, Stephen. He said, you can't just end up in prison. You got to tell the whole thing. And so that book is as much as the truth as we could give out without hurting people, and probably still hurt people.
How many years were you sentenced to prison?
45 years.
45 years. So you'd still be in prison now, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. But Alan Dershowitz came, he read about me in the New Yorker, I believe it was, magazine, that I didn't get a fair trial. And he offered to represent me at no cost. And so when he did that, he represented me and I didn't pay him a penny. And he got my case thrown out. And not only did the case thrown out, he got the judge thrown out, thrown off the case. That the judge was prejudiced. And he proved that point. And then I went to the parole board and I gave them the facts, and they interviewed me, and they said, Jim, we believe you're not guilty. And so they said, we're going to grant you parole now. But yet went to D.C., and even the people in the prison there, the what's the head of the prison?
The warden.
Warden, actually, I think. He told me one day right after the appeal, he said, called me short timer. That's what they call when you're going to leave real soon. He was preparing for me to go home. And yet it was 2 years before I walked out of prison.
And then when you left, you had nothing. And you mentioned earlier in our conversation about Billy Graham. Didn't they reach out to you when you got out of prison?
Oh, absolutely. And one of my lowest moments in prison, Billy Graham, I always say he knocked on the door. He came up to the prison you have to have clearance before prison, before you can be visiting. But Billy Graham just went up to the prison and said, I want to see Jim Baker. And I was cleaning toilets, and I was that was my job. I was assigned toilets throughout the whole prison. And so I was sick with the flu, and the guards came and said, Jim, you got to, you need to go to the warden's office. I didn't even know why. And he led me across the grounds, and I talked to the guard, and he said, you got to visit Baker. You know, they always call you by your last name. Do you want your visit? I said, well, it's not visiting day, and I don't know anybody coming to see me. And he said, didn't they tell you? Billy Graham is here to see you. And, I mean, I was a mess. You couldn't.
Had you ever met him before?
Yes. I'd interviewed him on TV. I had him at the National Religious Broadcasters. We had the broadcasting of that whole
thing. So how did you feel?
Awful. My hair looked like I'd been sleeping under a bridge, because you have nothing to comb your hair with. And I had on shoes that my toes were hanging out because I had my toilet cleaning shoes on. And I had no idea I was going to see Billy Graham. And I felt so embarrassed. And then when they asked, they said, do you want to see him? And I looked down at my feet, and I thought, oh, God. I looked like a man who's been sleeping under a bridge. But I said yes. I didn't want to say no to somebody who was so kind to come. And
what did he say to you?
The main thing that he said to me, and he put his arms around me. He's a big guy. You know, I'm 5'8". He's about 8'5". You know, he's he's really a big guy. And as I walked into that room, the warden's assistant, the warden's, I think it was like a meeting room of some sort for the warden, and everybody in the prison, all the assistant wardens, everybody was there to see Billy Graham. I looked around. I mean, it was a spectacle almost. But I didn't see him hardly. But I remember back now seeing him all around like this. But my eyes were glued to Billy Graham's eyes. He's amazing eyes. And he put his arms around me. And he held me. I mean, he wasn't ashamed to hug me. And on the radio, like just hours before, he'd been voted one of the top three respected men in the world. Mm. And here he is showing up at my prison unexpectedly. But he held me and he said, "Jim, I love you."
Mm. How did that make you feel?
The world stopped. I mean, it was, somebody loved me. I was at the bottom of the barrel. My ex-wife left me in prison. And
that happens a lot, doesn't it, with prisoners?
Usually, a marriage lasts maximum, I think they said 2 years. But the, what's his name, who has been burnt in the,
Dave Reaver.
You know Dave Reaver?
I met him.
The day of my divorce was final. I don't know how these things happen. In the daytime, they were having in the chapel basement, Dave Reaver was there. I mean, I was at the lowest of the low. And then I walked down into that room in the below the chapel. And there again, Dave Reaver, scarred. That man scarred.
From the Vietnam War.
A bomb hanging his blew right up in his face and his fingers and his, you know. And I walked down those stairs, moldy old steps outside, and Dave Reaver threw his arms around me and said, "Jim, I love you." And he felt more sorry for me than at that moment than he felt for himself. He you know, he doesn't have self-pity. He laughs. He makes, and I know he's been through hell and back. But these are the real Christians. That's someday I'm going to write a book, maybe. The real Christians, they're there. My God, I wouldn't be here. I remember in the prison cell, when everything was coming apart, and the divorce was taking place, and I earned a doctorate in prison. I don't know if you knew that or not, but I studied the Bible and theology and all, and be able to earn my doctorate. And when I was taking my finals, and my wife had divorced me, and I'm there alone, and tears just streaming down my face, and I'm trying to see the computer, and I asked God for a miracle when I started the school in the prison. I asked God, I wanted all A's. I never was an all A student, but before God, I got all A's. Mm. And how I ever passed that exam. I even was taking computer layouts, you know, and computer math and computer, you know, how you one spreadsheet has to talk to the other spreadsheet. And I had to take the final of that, and I'm there dying. I'm serious. It was over. And I got A's. No, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do one question on that test today, probably. But I went back to my cell. And It was one of those days that it was the end. You just have those days in prison. You just... And it was winter time, and my hands, I have like an arthritis from my hands would be up against the walls, and the cold made it, the pain hurt. That's the only time I had pain is if it was cold. And I thought I couldn't go on. And all of a sudden, it was like hands, great hands, had picked me up, and I was floating in my bunk bed in that prison cell. And I said, God, what's happening? You know what God told me?
What did he say?
He said, this is the prayers of the people. And I know I would have never made it through prison without the prayers of the people. The prayers of the people physically lifted me up. I don't care if you believe me. It happened. At my lowest moment, it was like I was levitating. You might say I'm lifting up. And prison became my time of intimacy with God. Prison became, well, I asked God if he was mad at me and trying to get even with me. And he said, no. He said, I got even on the cross. Mm. He said, I want you to get to know me. That's why you're here. I want to teach you. I want you to get to know me even through the fellowship of his suffering. And you know, I know this sounds crazy, but I honestly, the first years in prison, I did not know why I was there. Mm. I didn't know. Nobody knew really, except people who were my enemies who just said, oh, he's a bad person. And even the courts, when they examined me and they gave me parole, said, you're not guilty of any crime. You haven't stolen anything? You haven't? And
it was all trumped up.
And so, yeah, that's a good word, isn't it, Trump? But even in that, I did an appeal to the parole board in Washington, D.C. Even after I had granted the parole, I was supposed to be walking out of there. And I mean, I've got copies of it, but I'd love to show you what I did in a prison cell, pictures and the whole thing, and documented. By then, I had the truth because the lawyers who represented my enemies came to my side. Can you believe that? So I thought I was going home. And instead, I had to spend 2 more years after being granted parole. And in that 2 years, I finished Revelation. Oh, I could tell you stories about that. In the mornings, I'd walk the trail, it was a track, and I had my headset on, and I heard David Jeremiah. Do you know David Jeremiah?
Yes, of course. Great man.
I was studying the Revelation, and I could write a book on this too, because I was at a point, and I said, I believe this person is Jesus, this big angel in the Revelation. And I said, that sounds like Jesus. And I turn on the radio, and David Jeremiah says, you know, this has to be Jesus.
What a confirmation.
I mean, it was like he's talking to me. And I had so many times like that. When the prison was getting unbearable the final year, I wanted to go home, and I didn't have a house to go to, but I wanted to go out. I wanted to get out of prison. I was just tired of being locked up. And the song, the God of the valley is the God of the mountain. I don't know if you remember that song, but
old gospel song.
Old gospel, and the lady and her family that sing it, there's like almost country kind of song. And they, what's her name? McKinney's. Oh my God. I don't go here where I'm going today very much. I haven't gone here. I don't want to cry. But every day, every night, I mean, that song must have been very popular. But I would just turn on the radio, it wouldn't make any difference where it go. It was the God of the mountain is the God in the valley, the God in the valley is the God of the mountain, whatever it was. And they were, she would laugh in that song and shout. And I mean, I wish we could book them back, guys, whoever books around here. That song, a song, helped save my life then. Wow. You need those anchors. You need something. But that one, the God of the valley.
You know, there's almost no one who will experience the depths that you've been describing. I mean, it's just so sad. Yet it can speak to people because everyone has problems. Everyone will have low points and to respond like you did. So let's end on a happy note.
But I know him.
And that's why everybody needs to get to know him.
I know him in the fellowship of his suffering. And that's unusual. Because I did not know, and I know people will criticize me for this, but I did not know why I was in prison. I asked God. I asked, but God spoke to me that he allowed me to come there. He wanted me to get to know him. And I'm alive today because of Christ. That's the only reason I'm alive.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, and we could talk hours about this, but I want to end on a happy note.
Okay.
When you got out of prison,
You
met the most beautiful woman.
Yes.
Tell me, just briefly,
you got me.
How that came to be, and tell me something funny that happened when you met Lori.
Oh, my. I got out of prison, and the longing to go home and have no home to go to. So Franklin Graham met me at the airport. He brought me two briefcases because he couldn't make up his mind which one I would like. And I said, well, I don't need a briefcase. He said, yes, you do. You're going to need a briefcase. He had faith that I was going to go out and preach and all. So I went to my son, Jamie Charles, went to Phoenix first to go to school. And I couldn't help him. He just needed the word. And so I called Tommy Burnett up and I asked him if he could come there. And he said, oh, sure, Jim. And the wild thing of this, so Jamie was going to give his testimony. And so Tommy invited me to come to the service. And he said, well, you can hide in the back. Because I said, people spit on me. I said, I can't go out. And he asked me to come there, and it was an amazing night. Some say it's one of the great moments of history up to the church, and I don't know about that, but I know it was a great moment in my life. And the story is so big, but on that stage that night was all the different, he has like 200 different ministries, and there was probably 10,000 people there, outside even watching on screens.
I've seen the video, you're right.
And so this was the first time I spotted my wife-to-be. And she was doing a ministry with a couple other ladies on the healing of women who've had abortions, restoring them. And she'd been through this healing process. And I saw her on that stage. You want me to tell you something funny? Can I? I don't know.
Please.
My wife's here in the audience, so I don't know. I'll tell you the funny thing, because you said to do something funny.
We want to end on happy notes.
I'm pretty serious right now on this whole thing. But she's gorgeous, you know, and she was on that stage. And everywhere I went, I was asking preachers to pray for a wife for me. I needed a wife. I need a wife. And so I was thinking, boy, I'd like to date her. But Tommy introduced her and said, she's not married. But she's had 5 abortions, and I thought, she's not married, she's had 5 abortions. And I thought, she must be a hooker. You know, that's supposed to be funny, because it's, don't make me sit here. I shouldn't tell this, because this is embarrassing. But what happened, her abortions were because her husband didn't want babies, didn't want to fool with kids. Wow. And said he either him or the babies. And so it was a story that it really touched my heart in her book. When she first wrote her book, it was really touching to me. But I didn't meet her that night. I didn't ask her out. So I ended up going to the Dream Center with Tommy Burnett's place and Matthew Burnett in Los Angeles. And Mondo, who's been with me now 21 years, was there. And he met me at the airport with the kids. They pick you up. And I mean, I didn't know who he was. He came up and he said, "Man, I love you." I preached on a Thursday night, hadn't preached in a long time. And I mean, it was an amazing moment. And I asked the audience, I said, "Have some of you been in prison?" About 95% of them had been in prison, including Mondo. But Mondo has been with me ever since that day. However, Mondo produces my show now. He's from the ghetto of L.A. And then one day, God restored me, really. Part of my restoration, one of the biggest parts of it came from the Dream Center. I was in the ghetto with him. We were out sweeping streets. We were visiting people's homes. We were cleaning houses, painting houses. That's how they have stopped over 70% crime in that area where the Dream Center is. And so I came out of church on a Thursday night, and Jamie Charles, my son, introduces me to Lori, my wife now. And he had met her at Phoenix First, but he was just, Lori was trying to help him, trying to teach him and trying to bring him through. And he told her one day, he said, this is another kind of funny thing, but he says, "If my dad ever sees you, he's going to fall in love with you."
And he was right.
And he was right. So I met her in the alley out behind the Dream Center where we had service there. It was the gymnasium, like. And I asked her to go to eat with us, and she said to preach the next day. She said no. Usually I would never ask again because I'm shy and I feel rejection. But I met her there and fell madly, madly, madly in love with her. And I thought you're supposed to have violins and wheat blowing in the wind, you know, and everything. Instead, we were out by the garbage trucks and junk out back and in the ghetto. And we went, R.T. Kendall, whose book saved my life, we went to England for our honeymoon. We got married in 7 weeks. At my age, you get married.
You have to hurry.
You get married when you find the wife. So we went to England on our honeymoon, courtesy of R.T. Kendall. And the story is so big, but the miracles are there. There's so many diamonds of testimony of healing and of miracles in my life that it would take a year just to tell the story.
Hours and hours of video. And maybe when I come back to Morningside sometime, we can pick up, because there's such a story here. In fact, I wrote an article about it in Charisma Magazine. Yeah. And I'd like to go in depth. But today you've opened your heart. Thank you so much. We've gone in depth a lot more than I thought we probably would. And I hope the listeners enjoyed it and the viewers. And we'll just have to wait for the rest of the story another time.
Okay.
So to my listeners, to In Depth with Stephen Strang, I want to thank you for listening. And I hope the partners of PTL enjoyed this video that we put together. And thank you for listening. Thank you for watching, and God bless you.
This is Stephen Strang. I want to give my listeners a special offer of getting 2 years of Charisma Magazine for only $20. This is better than two for one. I hope you want Charisma in your home, where you can read it, where you can share, where you can keep it around the house and sometimes look at an article later. You know, with everything that's happening with digital, we have found that people still want Charisma in print. And I've been sharing this in my last few podcasts, and it's interesting that the subscriptions are coming in, and I hope that you'll take advantage of this offer by going to charismamag.com 2, T-W-O. That means 2 years for the price of one for only $20.
This has been a production of the Charisma Podcast Network. Steve and Joyce Strang are the founders and owners of CPN. Dr. Steve Green is the executive producer of the Charisma Podcast Network. We intend to honor God with every podcast and remain thankful to our advertisers and supporters who make these podcasts possible.